Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the drumbeat of war that is drowning out alternative approaches to the crisis in Syria, and go to Ireland to speak with Patrick Coben, the Middle East correspondent for the UK Independent, where he has an article, "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." We'll discuss his contention that the slaughter of civilians by chemical weapons is both a crime and an opportunity, and examine the possibility of pursuing peace before the trigger is pulled on war. Then we will speak with Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and the author of The World Through Arab Eyes. We will discuss Syria as the third and most recent Arab country to face civil war after enduring decades of dictatorship, with Iraq and Libya in chaos after being liberated by US and NATO military force. We will look at the prospect of avoiding the destruction and division of Syria, which is caught in both a regional proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran and a wider contest between the US and Russia, both of whom do not want al-Qaeda to take over Syria. Then finally, we will speak with David Courtwright, an American scholar and peace activist who is the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. We will discuss alternatives to the use of military force in Syria that are not on the table, and the disconnect between an almost unanimous call for military action from political leaders, while only 9% of the American people support the U.S. going to war in Syria. Joining us now from Ireland is Patrick Coben, who has been a Middle East correspondent for over three decades, first for the Financial Times and currently for The Independent in the United Kingdom. His latest article at The Independent is "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Coben.
Thank you.
Now, it seems that the drumbeat of war started with the French foreign minister, followed by the British foreign minister, and then Secretary of State John Kerry. And while it appears that the president is about to pull the trigger, you have written an article suggesting that the horrible chemical attack in Damascus on August the 21st is both a crime and an opportunity.
Yeah, I think that, you know, these airstrikes are going to happen. Those involved the U.S. and France and Britain already committed to it, and they're not going to walk away from this, so that's going to happen. But, you know, what happens afterwards? And I think that the reason I think it's an opportunity is that the chemical attacks show that you can't just leave the Syrian civil war to rage on and hope that it won't drag in outside powers, that it won't affect the area. So I think there's a stronger motive. It's given a shock to everybody, a stronger motive for having a peace conference, and to look, at least at first, simply for a ceasefire to stop the level of violence ever escalating and Syria disintegrating.
Well, of course, there are specialists over here in the national security community who are suggesting that you can sort of separate this Syrian civil war and all of the intractable issues involved there. And there is, of course, an asymmetry between the fact that the Russians, the Hezbollah, and the Iranians seem to be determined to back the Assad government, but the West and the United States has been extremely ambivalent about who to back on the other side. But given that asymmetry, there's this belief that somehow you can do a punitive military strike as a signal against crossing the line, the red line, over the use of chemical weapons, and somehow not get involved in the outcome of the Syrian civil war.
Yes, I think, I mean, that's clearly Obama's dilemma. The British and the French seem less concerned about getting involved, but they're not sort of leading the pack on this. The U.S. is. I think that it's difficult to balance. Obama will. They want to give the Assyrians more than a slap on the wrist, so I think it'll be the attacks will be pretty wide ranging. On the other hand, they don't want to be in the position that they were in Libya, which they wanted in Libya, which they were basically trying to and succeeded eventually in overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi. At the time, there was something of a pretense that this was the militiamen, but actually it was NATO that did that. I don't think they want to be in that position. And it's a very different situation. As you just mentioned, Russia and Iran and Hezbollah are very committed to supporting the Syrian government. They're not going to just fold their hands and go away. So it's a difficult balance to achieve.
But in your article with the UK Independent, Patrick Herman, only a peace conference, not airstrikes, can stop further bloodshed, you make the point, which I think is important, that Syria has a failed government and a failed opposition. And if indeed the country disintegrates, which it's been doing in this slow and agonizing way, it will eventually be overrun by warlords, and there'll be even less of an interest in peace. So you're making the case, I guess, now that it's either now or never.
Not quite, no. I mean, now or never for a peace conference, yes, because it gets ever more difficult. There are ever more players involved. You've got to... who exactly would represent the opposition? You know, within Syria, there are about 1,200 groups, big and small, involved in the fighting. Some of these are very tough, you know, are affiliated to, some of the biggest are affiliated to Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, there are some positive things that all these different groups on the government and the opposition, the rebels, are dependent on outside backers, so they can be pressured. In the middle of the war, I mean, particularly one as bitter as this, I don't think that you can have long-term solutions to Syria's political problems. What you need to do at this stage is have a ceasefire, have the UN there monitoring and supporting that ceasefire, and then if you can bring down the level of violence, maybe you can proceed then to longer-term solutions. But the alternative is just the war going on and the war getting worse and worse.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Herman, who has been a Middle East correspondent for over three decades, first for the Financial Times and currently for the UK Independent. His latest article at the UK Independent is "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." Now, in your article, Patrick Herman, you say that peace conferences have the best chance of succeeding when one side knows it has won and wants to formalize its victory, while the defeated wants the best terms possible. Alternatively, peace negotiations may be productive when both sides are exhausted and come to realize they are not going to win a complete victory. So which of those two scenarios do you see as most likely, or is it a combination of both?
I think the second is most likely. I mean, we have a stalemate at the moment. The government had some successes. It took an important town called Kuzair, but it hasn't been able to advance much further. The opposition has taken some places. Basically, you've had, really for about a year now, you've had a stalemate, and I can't see either side defeating the other. I mean, it's also both sides have a core of support that isn't going to put up its hands and is going to fight to the end. So I'm not sure that that in Syria the government or the opposition think that way. I think they both think that if they play their cards right, they might come out an outright winner. But I think that that's completely unrealistic. So you have this bloody stalemate going on, and you need them to realize that this is not going to change and force them to go to a peace conference.
Well, of course, nobody, I think, imagines it's going to be easy to get these two sides, you know, how do you get negotiations going between people whose primary aim is to kill each other, as you point out. Now, I have spoken in the last couple of days to a former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who was the character that George Clooney played in the movie Syriana, and he spent a lot of time. He's still on the phone all day with the Alawite officers and with the rebels and stays in touch with the country and speaks their language. And then yesterday I spoke with the English language spokesperson for the Syrian local coordinating committees, the umbrella group for the opposition And in the case of Bob Baer, he said that for the Alawites, this is existential, that they believe that there will be no mercy shown, so they have to fight with their backs against the wall. On the other hand, when I brought that up with the Syrian spokesperson for the opposition or for this, whatever this Free Syrian Army really is, she said, no, it's only the Assad family that feel this existential threat. So where do you come down on that?
It's sort of the problem is the opposition doesn't really address this fear among the Alawites, actually among all the minorities. A lot of people just work for the government of what's going to happen to them if the opposition win. You know, you have these people, let's say, you know, you're sitting in Damascus. You can't really go out much in the evening. There isn't a lot to do. You're watching the internet. You go to YouTube and you see pictures of Alawite officers having their throats cut. You see pictures of, priests being having their heads chopped off by jihadis. So, you know, not surprisingly, you think, you know, I'm going to fight to the end. There's no, I've got no alternative. And the opposition doesn't really, has never addressed these fears, which is one of the reasons that the government has been able to hang on. They just sort of are in denial and sort of pretend it isn't happening. So what has happened, and this may have changed a little because of these horrific use of poison gas, but you know, you have a lot of people in Damascus and elsewhere, Syrians who don't like the government, but wish the government would go. But then they look at the alternative, and they think, you know, that might even be worse.
Well, more recently, we've seen examples of the opposition, particularly the al-Nusra people, in the ethnic cleansing of Syrian Kurds, who literally thousands just flocked across this rickety pontoon bridge across the Tigris to escape into Iraqi Kurdistan, fearing for their lives. So there's some evidence that life under al-Nusra will not be particularly pleasant.
Yeah, I mean, there are 2 million Syrian Kurds. I mean, that's 10% of the population. And these people are in flight, you know, and there are thousands of more trying to escape. So, you know, that's part of the disintegration of the country. You know, in a way, it's sort of in the interests of these extreme groups and indeed of the Assad family to keep a war, to keep make sure that everybody is thoroughly frightened of everybody else. If you do have a ceasefire, then there might be a bit more political space in which there could be changes. You know, there are plenty on the government side who don't like the opposition, but they don't much like Assad either. But so long as there's a war, you know, you don't really have time to think about these things. You're just fighting the enemy.
Well, it's clear there that this has become a proxy war, isn't it? I mean, and you do have the Saudis on the one side supporting al-Nusra and the Iranians on the other. So, and then outside of that inner circle, if you will, you have the outer circle of the United States and Russia. And more recently, President Obama was characterizing his dealings with Putin when he canceled the summit meeting after the G20 by literally characterizing Putin as a sort of scowling, surly schoolboy sitting in the corner. So the prospects of the U.S. and Russia talking aren't particularly good, are they?
Well, they were going to, I mean, on some things like, you know, Snowden, not good. But on the other hand, if it hadn't been for this poison gas attack, they were meant to be having a quite serious meeting to set up a peace conference. That's now been cancelled. Maybe it'll happen later. That they have quite a lot in common. They don't want this to spin out of control. But, you know, the problem, as I was saying, is that there are so many players involved now, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. You know, you have about five different struggles in going on in Syria. You had one at the beginning, which was you know, the people against a dictatorship. That sort of, to a degree, still goes on, but it's also a sectarian struggle of the Sunni against the Alawites and the Shia. You know, it's an international struggle of Saudi Arabia and the U.S. against Iran. It's the touch of the Cold War, U.S. against Russia. So all these sort of struggles are going on simultaneously, and they sort of cross-infect each other, and they make a solution very difficult to achieve.
So in terms of the political DNA of the West and of Russia and the Soviet Union, is there a difference? In other words, so much of what we have been told over the throughout the Cold War and since is that the defining moment was the appeasement of Hitler, was Chamberlain, and that we can't afford appeasement anymore. And I think that's the subtext for this argument over the use of chemical weapons, that you simply cannot appease the use of weapons of mass destruction. Is that an argument, do you think, would appeal to the Russians? And if you go back to appeasement in World War II, of course, you have the Hitler-Stalin Pact. So give me a sense.
Yeah, I think the Russians probably privately pretty appalled by this. I mean, for strategic as much as moral reasons. But, you know, and when you think of it, it was incredibly assuming, I suppose, one, the evidence isn't all in, but it's very difficult to think of any alternative candidate other than the Syrian army to have used poison gas on a mass scale. I can't believe the opposition would have the capability of a sort of mass fake. But the Russians say, well, you know, it's wait for the evidence and so forth. But it's reasonable for Kerry and the others to say the evidence is largely in. But will the Russians, how will they react now? They'll stick with Syria. I mean, this is one of the new things in the situation, or something we haven't really seen for 20 years, is Russia behaving as a powerful state with an important ally that it's going to protect. It hasn't really done that since about 1990, since the first Gulf War and the final years of the Soviet Union. It's been too divided or it's been too weak. But in Syria, they're going to stick. Iran and Hezbollah, well, they've been, you know, they read early on that getting rid of the Assad regime was one of the main motives was to weaken Iran, weaken Hezbollah. So they think if we have to fight, we'll fight now. So I don't think any of those allies of Assad are really going to change their stance.
But given that I think the Russians have obviously told us privately, and I believe Kerry and Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, have supposed to have a good relationship, that surely the Russians have pointed out that they're much closer, their Caucasus are much closer to Syria, 500 miles, and that they're afraid that the same kind of people that are giving them trouble in the Caucasus are going to end up running Syria. Now, you would think that on the American side, they would recognize that the U.S. would have blood on its hands if al-Nusra were the winner here, if al-Qaeda's affiliate. After all, we have this war on terror that's supposed to be aimed at al-Qaeda. It's the idea that the United States would allow the al-Qaeda people to take over and slaughter the Alawites and the Christians and everybody else that they don't like. That's an intolerable thought, too. So you'd think that there'd be some common ground between Russia and the United States.
Yeah, there is common ground there, I think, which was why, you know, Kerry and Lavrov agreed some earlier in this year, in May, to have a Geneva peace conference in Geneva. But, you know, there are other things that enter into it. The Russians say, not unreasonably, that the Iranians are big players in this and they should be there. But the U.S. is confronting Israel and Saudi Arabia, confronting Iran over nuclear weapons. They don't want to sort of recognize Iran as a regional power. But if you don't have the Iranians there, then it's very difficult to have a serious peace conference. So, you know, that's what I meant by saying that a whole series of different confrontations have sort of all been come together in Syria, which makes it so difficult to reach any solution or even have a conference of any kind.
But the point that you make, though, is certainly resonates, that this horrible crime could also be an opportunity. And I don't see anybody thinking in those terms. I just hear the drumbeat of war.
Yeah, there is at the moment, and maybe it'll just go on that way. And certainly, you know, that's not unexpected. If they're about to launch airstrikes, they're not going to... what they want to do is batter and frighten the Assad government. So, but the question is, what happens afterwards? Are they going to support the opposition in the belief that ultimately the opposition will triumph? On the other hand, that, for the reason you just mentioned, is not probably not good news for the Syrian people, and it's not good, and certainly not good news for the U.S. to find an opposition in power in Damascus in which the most powerful military elements are linked to al-Qaeda. So if they don't want that to happen, what's the alternative? Well, the alternative, I think, should be, as I said, to and there is, Russia and America are in a position to pressurize their allies, their proxies on the ground. There is a conference, and as I said, I think sort of the initial thing would be to see if a ceasefire can be arranged to have the UN there. This isn't going to be perfect. It isn't going to last. But, you know, ceasefires, even when they're periodic, mean that a lot of people don't get killed who would have been killed otherwise.
Well, Patrick Cabin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Patrick Coburn, who has been a Middle East correspondent for over three decades, first for the Financial Times and currently for the UK Independent. His latest article at the Independent is "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." We're going to take a brief station break and we're back with a further perspective on the idea that there might be an opportunity in this crime. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shibli Tilhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He has served as an advisor to the United States mission to the United Nations and most recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. His best-selling book, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, was selected by Foreign Affairs as one of the top five books on the Middle East, and he's the co-author of Liberty and Power, A Dialogue on Religion and U.S. Foreign Policy in an Unjust World. And his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shibli Tilhami.
My pleasure.
And in the introduction to the program, which you didn't hear, Shibli, I said that in terms of this segment, I said we will discuss Syria as the third and most recent Arab country to face civil war after enduring decades of dictatorship, with Iraq and Libya in chaos after being liberated by U.S. and NATO military force. We will look at the prospects for avoiding the destruction and division of Syria, which is caught in both a regional proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran and a wider context between the U.S. and Russia, both of whom do not want al-Qaeda to take over Syria. So good news and bad news. Start with the bad news.
I think when you look at the situation in Syria is it's very hard in any foreseeable future to see an outcome that is stable or that is good for its neighbors and its people. It's very hard, and that's really the bad news. I think it's look at what has transpired over the last couple of years. What started as primarily an uprising against an authoritarian regime really has become so complicated, not only because of the sectarianism that is at the core of Syrian society, but also because of the intervention of so many international players who have a stake in the outcome. And it's become multi-layered, very difficult to separate. It's very hard for the U.S. To do something in Syria without thinking about how the Turks are going to react, or how the Russians are going to react, or how the Iranians are going to react, or how Hezbollah is going to react. So all of that is really making it far more difficult for anybody to contemplate a real solution.
Well, it's pretty clear that President Obama is not George W. Bush or Dick Cheney, that he seems to be cautious and thoughtful about these things. But when you start with the statements from the French foreign minister and then the French president, the British foreign secretary, and then the prime minister, and then you have Chuck Hagel, and now you have the vice president weighing in, and I presume perhaps on Thursday after Martin Luther King's 50th anniversary celebration, the president may say something or even do something. In all of this, is there any voices out there that are at least counseling caution?
Well, I think the train has already left the station. I really do. I think if there was any doubt about that, I think the statement by Secretary Kerry yesterday made it very clear. And so I think a decision has been made to do something, because the way they stated the facts in terms of not only the massacre itself or the using chemical weapons, but directly blaming Assad for doing it, it's making it impossible for them to go back. So the real question is what it is that they're going to do, and who will partnering with the U.S. Now, obviously, this isn't going to be something that the U.N. is going to support. Russia clearly will not support this, and neither will China. So can you have a coalition, first of all, of perhaps NATO plus some Arab states, and what sort of action it will be, and what is the aim? So I think we're all watching not to see whether there will be action. I think it's a foregone conclusion. I think only the Syrian foreign minister, who just issued a statement saying he's still unconvinced that military action will take place, I think he's the only one who is unconvinced. I think it's pretty foregone conclusions, just a question of what shape and form it will take.
But as I mentioned in the opening introduction, this is the third Arab country to be involved in a civil war and perhaps have foreign military forces intervene, as happened in Iraq and then in Libya, and the results in both the case of Iraq and Libya are pretty sad. They certainly got rid of a dictator. Is that a part of the problem here, that these dictatorships that last for decades, they just simply ruin countries? I mean, what's your sense of the prospects of building a country anew if somehow or other the Assad family disappears?
Well, I think obviously what dictators do is make sure that they are the state, and therefore they in a way demolish a possibility that you can have a state without them, and people start equating the state with the dictator and the threat to the dictator, the threat to the state. The extreme version of that was, of course, Gaddafi, who actually in a way abolished many of the institutions of the state to create this direct rule. So yes, it's in part how some dictators govern, which make it very difficult for alternatives, but in part it's also how the transition is handled and who's doing it. And I think, frankly, foreign intervention in the Middle East has not worked. If you look at that over the decades, it's the British experience, the French experience, the American experience, is tremendous resistance. Even those people who, on the face of it, seem to want help will not thank you if you seem to be even intervening on humanitarian grounds, because there is so much suspicion of the intention of the West. And we see that dating back to, the inception of the modern political system after World War I. So the U.S. hasn't had a very successful record, frankly, in managing it. And in the Iraq case, it is clear that one of the big mistakes that were made was destroying the two significant institutions that could have helped build a stable country, that is the military and the Ba'ath Party. In retrospect, that was something that was seen as a mistake in helping bring it about. In Syria, obviously the civil war is not mostly due to direct foreign intervention. It happened on its own. And the intervention is complicating it, even though it's at a small scale. I suspect that after whatever the U.S. is going to do, it's going to be even more complicated because it may be something U.S. has to do in part because of the humanitarian disaster, but it is unlikely to make the peaceful outcome closer the next morning.
Now, but if would this be happening, Shibli Talhami, had President Obama not drawn the red line, or is this happening because of the red line over the use of WMD? I mean, in other words, how much do you think the president is trapped by his own rhetoric, or how much is he obliged to act because of this idea that a weapon of mass destruction is being used against civilians?
It's a really good question. And obviously, you know, there are a lot of people are saying, you know, don't draw these superficial lines and keep your options open. There's something to be said for that. But let's be realistic here. Number one, public opinion in the U.S. isn't pushing the president to act. Remember that.
No, 9%. Only 9% of the American people support military action in Syria.
And even when people are convinced that Assad actually used chemical weapons on large scale, you only get about 25% support. So there is no public pressure on him. So what is the red line for whom? You know, the credibility maybe in the international community, but ultimately when you act and you pay a price, I'm not sure that the price you pay is lesser than the seeming cost to your reputation here. So I don't really know, you know, where this idea comes that the red line, therefore, he's obligated to follow, particularly when there is no public pressure. Second, I think that, you know, obviously they had made the decision before the UN concluded its investigation. Now, they may have concluded, you know, that it's a useless investigation, fine, but they didn't even try to use it as a fig leaf. So, you know, perhaps they've concluded for themselves with some degree of certainty that, Assad did use it. But they could have, if they really wanted to get out of it, used this fig leaf and work with it or waited to see what happened and then put the Russians on the defensive or somebody else on the defensive and see how the rest of the world would act. So the decision, in my own view, was done, it could not have been simply because of the chemical weapons. I think they may have been a strategic decision. They had to weigh all sorts of things, including the fact that even to enter the negotiations in Geneva, Assad seemed to have the upper hand, and there was no element there weakening him. They may have thought that this element would give an opportunity to weaken him, to make it more possible for a negotiation. It is also possible the president feels he needs to look tough a little bit. He hasn't done that of late, and he's facing some additional challenges down the road, perhaps with regard to Iran, something he really doesn't want to do. So it's hard to, I wouldn't just pin it all on the chemical weapons. I think it's certainly chemical weapons deserve response if they were used, and I think that's a separate issue, obviously morally. But policy-wise, I suspect there was a strategic element as well in the picture.
And again, I'm speaking with Shibli Talhami, who's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and the Senior Fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the U.S. mission, to the UN, and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. His latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. So if there is a new strategic calculus, then if there was a policy prior to this, and as I've mentioned in the previous interview, that there's an asymmetry between the commitments that the Iranians and Hezbollah and Russia have to support the Assads and the ambivalence that the West and America has about who it is they're supporting on the rebel side, and they haven't really furnished any significant amounts of arms. So a lot of cynics were suggesting that that's the policy, to have both sides exhaust, to to draw Iran in, and it's costing Iran a lot financially, and it's cost Hezbollah a lot in terms of its credibility, and that they were just going to wait for both sides to, you know, duke it out and get exhausted. You're suggesting that something else may have changed. Is the former scenario plausible to you?
Well, I don't think so. I'm sure there are people who might see some utility in that, but I've seen obviously the public discourse on this. I don't think so. I think what happened with the administration is it started off, swept in its thinking by the Arab uprisings, particularly in Tunisia and Egypt. They were peaceful. They were successful. It looked like history is going in one direction. Libya came along, and then ultimately ended with Syria, and they have taken their, they had taken sides. As you can see, the administration took a position very quickly that Assad must go before they even had contemplated what the consequences of that statement is. But they took a position very simply against Assad, and I think two things happened. One is it turned out it wasn't that simple. It wasn't happening on its own. And number two, when they supported the coalition, they were wholeheartedly behind the idea of supporting the opposition against Assad until they discovered that the Al-Qaeda groups were the ones who were doing much of the fighting, and they stood to gain. And the fear of repetition of Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan really crept in, and the administration applied the brakes, and it paralyzed its ability to maneuver, and it became reactive in its policy. And when you're reactive, you allow everyone else to dictate your policy, what you do, because people know your weaknesses and your strengths, and they push the right button. And so I think that's where they are. I think the policy is needs to be revisited. I think this is obviously an opportunity for them to rethink. They're going to have to rethink no matter what, because once you engage in military action, the next morning the world changes. The world today will look different after this action, because wars sweep the rug from under you, and they always have, and even limited wars have unanticipated consequences. So they'll wake up to a different world the next morning. They'll wake up to a different relationship with Syria, and they're going to have to reassess. They don't know what it's going to look like, because that's the case with wars.
Well, assuming they take out the airport and stop the supply from aerial supply coming in over Iraq, which the U.S. has tried to get the Iraqis to stop, from Iran, stop, damage the port of Latakia or whatever, to stop the Russians continuing the supply, and then take out every castle, every place that every home. I mean, this is the private plantation of the Assad family, the country of Syria. So there's a whole bunch of opulent palaces, that et cetera. At the end of the day, aren't you going to be, in effect, in a more likely position that more chemical weapons are going to be used if you weaken them sufficiently?
Personally, I think that the use of the chemical weapons, besides being immoral, is strategically stupid for Assad. And I suspect that I'm still scratching my head. I mean, I assume the administration has evidence, because it's very hard to see what sort of incentive they do, particularly when they have the overwhelming capacity to choke the opposition and destroy them with overwhelming military hardware. So why would they need these chemical weapons to kill 200-400 people, and then get all of the anger of the international community, put themselves on the wrong side, and so forth? It doesn't, it makes you scratch your head. I mean, this doesn't make sense, separate from the immorality of it. And that's why I think, I'm still trying to figure out for what reason would they use them. And I think one of the possible explanations is what the Israelis, one Israeli, at least, was quoted by the New York Times as saying that something maybe went operationally wrong, that perhaps they were trying to use them on a limited scale to scare the opposition, and it went out of control, and they ended up killing a lot of people. So I don't really see the chemical weapons use as helping them strategically, except in a in an all-out war when they know they're going to be destroyed.
Well, that's what I was suggesting. That's maybe the next stage. And I thank you for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Shibli Talhami, who's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and Senior Fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. His latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into alternatives to military force in Syria.
اكتب واخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب واخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس ما لي حدا يا ناس ما لي حدا بهمي وعسيني
Now I've been crying lately thinking about the world as it is Why must we go to warm Haiti? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a beast train. Oh, beast train, take this country, come take me home again. Oh, beast train, sounding louder.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Courtwright, who is an American scholar and peace activist. He is Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and previously was the Executive Director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which under his direction became the largest disarmament organization in the U.S., later merging with the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. And in 2002, he helped to found the Win Without War Coalition in opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. His most recent books are Ending Obama's War, Responsible Military Withdrawal from Afghanistan, and Towards Nuclear Zero. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Courtwright.
Yes, hello again. How are you?
Well, I'm well, and unfortunately, David, in the next couple of days, I think, with this drumbeat of war, I suppose there's no way that the president is going to start bombing Syria while he's celebrating Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream speech on Wednesday. But perhaps as early as Thursday, there's a certain inevitability about this military punitive strike against Syria. Do you feel that in this rush for war, with this drumbeat for war, which we're all too familiar with, that the other alternatives are simply not only are they being drowned out, they're not even being approached or floated.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the president has boxed himself in with this foolish statement that he made previously about red lines and Syria and the use of chemical weapons. And, of course, here we have a massive use of these weapons, a heinous attack against people that has apparently left many hundreds dead and thousands seriously harmed. So it's almost impossible for the president not to act, unfortunately, because of the nature of the act and of the policies the president has put in place and the threat that he made, this hollow threat, but now he's forced to try to implement it. But the main point here is that so we can bomb and send missile attacks into Syria, and then what? And what would be accomplished? And meanwhile, the other options that might be available are not even being considered. I've argued for quite a long time, and colleagues here have as well, that if there is evidence of this kind of chemical attack, which appears to be the case now, well, then this should be brought immediately to the UN Security Council and to the International Criminal Court. We have these institutions that have been created for this purpose. If we can identify those responsible, they should be brought before the international court and indicted as war criminals. And then we can begin to consider actions against them, certainly bringing them before a legal tribunal. And if ultimately it is a decision that military force could be used, it should only be with multilateral endorsement through the UN Security Council or if the Russians continue to balk within the Security Council, perhaps within the UN General Assembly. But there are other avenues for taking action when we're faced with this kind of potential criminal act. But first of all, we need to bring it to the Security Council, to the International Criminal Court. Let's look at the evidence, make sure that we're certain who actually ordered these attacks. Was it rogue military commanders, or was it ordered from the top by Assad and the government? Who is really responsible? We really don't have that evidence yet. Appearances are one thing, but firm evidence is necessary before we would take such drastic action as to launch military strikes.
But David Courtright, the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is how paralyzed the United Nations Security Council is, that Russia and China have blocked all efforts to put pressure on Assad to stop killing his own people.
Well, but Russia did agree to the UN inspection team that would go into Iraq and try to get evidence on the ground and through interviews as to what actually happened and who is responsible. And I think even now they seem to be supportive of the UN inspection visiting. Now, it's true that the inspectors will not be able to get physical evidence, you know, forensic evidence that could be used in court, but they are interviewing Syrian victims and interviewing people in the neighborhoods, and through that process hopefully can gather enough evidence, and that then should be brought to the Security Council. Certainly the Russians would be willing to go that far, and these steps are necessary in any case. So I think it's likely, you're right, that Russia would balk at any kind of military action against Syria, but maybe that's the wisest decision anyway, because we understand the impulse. You want to take action and punish those responsible for this crime, but the point of law is to prevent future crimes. It's also to establish legal accountability and responsibility for the person who ordered these actions. And that process will take time. And if we launch military strikes, as it seems likely now, then we've basically foreclosed those options. And the consequences, I'm afraid, of the U.S. and other countries perhaps joining in, becoming involved in military action here, will be to escalate what's already a savage war, and perhaps will lead to even further violence in the region. A very little likelihood that the kind of military action that's being talked about would be able to prevent future atrocities like this, nor would it likely have much impact on the Assad regime, which is fighting for its life against armed rebels there in Syria. So what's the point of the military action? It's just sort of revenge. And also it's necessary to somehow hold up Obama's credibility, I suppose. But that's not a legitimate reason for using military force. And there's no basis for it, of course, in international law.
Again, I'm speaking with David Courtright, who's an American scholar and peace activist. He's the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And previously, he was executive director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which under his direction became the largest disarmament organization in the U.S., later merging with the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. And in 2002, he helped to found the Win Without War Coalition in opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. His most recent books are Ending Obama's War, Responsible Military Withdrawal from Afghanistan, and Towards Nuclear Zero. So given that we're in the environment of the drumbeat of war drowning out other suggestions and alternatives that are fairly hard to find, but is there a possibility that the threat of war could in itself be used as leverage to find a way to get to peace? In other words, not to pull the trigger, but to use this moment to make some kind of deal, to get the Russians and the Americans back on the same page. Because at the end of the day, the two fundamental things that Russia and America have in common is that neither wants Syria to end up in the hands of Al-Qaeda.
That's right. And this is the other option that's not being pursued as a result of possible military action, and that is diplomacy. And this very much pertains to Russia's role. Now, it's true they've been blocking a lot of action in the Security Council, but they have been willing to cooperate with Secretary of State Kerry in the idea of having a peace conference in which all the parties would come to the table and try to work out some sort of negotiated solution. Obviously, that's not made any progress, and I was very disappointed to see that Secretary Kerry has canceled meetings that were planned with some of the assistant secretaries of state with Russian officials in Europe this week. Those meetings should go ahead, and it could be. I think you're right that the threat of military action is certainly something that the Assad regime is hoping to avoid. This is a grave threat to them. They are already seriously threatened by the scale of the rebellion against them. So perhaps this might convince them to come to the table. And conversely, in terms of the rebels, they are happy to see the U.S. and other countries intervening and taking military action against Assad. And perhaps they could be convinced on that basis to come to the table. So there might be an option here. It's difficult, but it seems to me it's an option that should be pursued. And this would argue then for the president. I presume he'll make a statement about this shortly. He might say that we're threatening this action, but we're still willing to hold out the option of diplomacy, and then instruct Secretary of State Kerry to really try to do a shuttle diplomacy effort among the Russians and the Syrians and the armed rebels in Syria and see if some kind of a negotiation could be initiated. Obviously, it'd be difficult, but I think that's another option that should be pursued. It's clear that both sides are in a stalemate here, that neither has been able to defeat the other. It's a grueling, savage battle. The levels of destruction, the killing is appallingly high. And so it may be that it's reaching the point where both sides might welcome some kind of an arrangement. Division of the country probably is going to be inevitable given the way the battles have gone. So maybe this could be some kind of a negotiated option. It seems to me that would be preferable to just plowing ahead with a major military onslaught, because that, I think, then would jeopardize the option for diplomacy. I could imagine that the Russians are going to react very negatively to this, and Kerry would probably lose the option of their cooperation in hosting a peace conference. And I think having the Russians on board will be crucial in order to get Assad, or parts of his government at least, to come to the table.
And David Cotright, you mentioned a little while ago President Obama's credibility being involved, and of course he's the one who drew the red line, which apparently the Syrian government, the Assad regime, or elements in it, have crossed. And as somebody that's spent decades working in nuclear disarmament, one of the things, of course, that was always on everybody's mind during the Cold War was crossing the nuclear threshold. And the fact that there's a threshold is really a sort of a line in the sand as well in terms of civilization. So how do you feel about the idea that another line in terms of weapons of mass destruction apparently has been crossed?
Well, certainly we want to prevent any country from developing and using any form of weapons of mass destruction. But the idea that there would be a red line declared unilaterally by one government and that this would then be a basis for using military action, there's no basis in international law for that. And in fact, it's contrary to what we know to be effective in preventing states from proliferating nuclear or chemical weapons. There have been successes over the decades in persuading some states to give up the bomb or to get rid of their chemical weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. And if you look at what happened in those cases, in almost all of them, it was through diplomacy. There has to be a negotiated solution. Usually political deals are cut, security assurances are provided, trade benefits and economic normalization, all sorts of diplomatic tools are brought to bear to persuade countries to give up the bomb or to dismantle chemical weapons. We need to be vigilant and supportive of initiatives that are aimed to prevent proliferation. But the use of military force is not the way to do it, and there's no legal basis for it, and there's no evidence that it really is successful. I mean, the one example where military force was used to disarm a country was in Iraq. first in 1990 and 91, and then in 2003 and afterwards. And in fact, the military force was not the factor that led to the disarmament of Iraq in 1991. It was the UN inspections on the ground. So in any case, the point is that in almost every other instance where we've had success in preventing or rolling back proliferation, it's been through diplomacy, not through unilateral military force.
So, David Cartwright, is there anybody that you can see out there in our politics and in our media that's having this conversation or making these points? Is there anybody weighing in on the president? I get the feeling that everybody, you know, starting with the French foreign minister, then the British foreign minister, and then their leaders as well, and now Kerry, everybody's saying, you know, bomb, bomb, bomb. I'm just wondering, is there any voices out there that can be built on?
Well, I have not seen it within the administration, unfortunately. There are some members of the Congress who are demanding that at least there should be a debate, which I certainly would agree with. Before the president acts, Congress needs to have a say in this. But I suspect, unfortunately, that 90% or more of the members of Congress would probably be in favor of military strikes. There are a few voices like Barbara Lee and others, other congressmen and congresswomen who have been raising some questions, but there are very few who are willing to argue for opposing military force or trying to suggest strategies for how these other options, such as the UN and the International Criminal Court or a new diplomatic push, these kinds of alternative options are really not being discussed in Washington, as far as I can tell.
And all this in the context of a recent poll that says only 9% of the American people support a war against Syria. So there's the disconnect. And I thank you so much for joining us, David Cartwright.
Okay. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Cartwright, who's an American scholar and peace activist. He's a director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and previously was the executive director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which under his direction became the largest disarmament organization in the U.S., later merging with the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. In 2002, he helped to found the Win Without War Coalition in opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. His most recent books are Ending Obama's War, Responsible Military Withdrawal from Afghanistan, and Towards Nuclear Zero. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.